हरि ओम. I think it's good to begin like they do in India. They try to explain in terms of spiritual accomplishment what the goal is, and then they backtrack and tell you how to get there. Where in the Western approach, which might be more practical, but both are successful, they explain the path and the goal becomes self-evident. But in the East there is a great proclamation made. It's actually turned into song by many. In fact, the great Swami Sivananda of Rishikesh, he says, "There is one God, only one God. Nameless is He, formless is He. In all names and in all forms as pure consciousness." So here we find a contradiction immediately, that one God is without name, without form, in all names and in all forms as pure consciousness. So right there, the purely Eastern approach is accomplished, where they're saying, okay, it's pure consciousness we're after. And pure consciousness actually manifested as compassion and love, which is the definition of God. Long-suffering compassion. It's interesting, even in the Bible, in Exodus, where Moses is on Mount Sinai and God is appearing to Moses. And then, after the Ten Commandments are given, Moses says, "I want to see you." Moses, "Appear to me. I want to see you." And God says, "You can't, because your physical vehicle that you're in, your body, mind, complex, just won't be able to stand it." This you see reflected also in the Ark of the Covenant. When it was being carried, they'd carry it with poles and they couldn't touch it. The idea being that this pure manifestation of all the truth and light was so concentrated that a human being couldn't touch it. But then the thing to comprehend is we're supposed to arrive at that. So Moses said, "Let me see you." And God says, "You can't. But what I'll do is, Moses, put your face into the cleft of a rock up on Mount Sinai, and I'll just walk by. I'll assume a very physical form, and I'll walk by, and you can feel my presence." And this is called the 10 utterances of Moses, where he actually tried to give definition or explain what he felt as the wake of God, like a boat goes by in a river and then the wake comes to you. So this wake of God, Moses made 10 utterances. The first three, he couldn't really put his mind around what he was experiencing, so he just said, "God." Then he tried to explain further and he just said, "God." And third, he just said, "God." But the fourth utterance of Moses, he was able to give some definition to this form of pure consciousness. And he said, "Long-suffering God." So right there we see this is something that we need to achieve as we're trying to develop and become truly, I guess, actually human, as was speaking earlier. In the Czechoslovakian language, the word they have for human, what we are, is the basis of the whole language. The language is called Čelovek. Čelovek being the language spoken in Czechoslovakia, especially by the religious Orthodox there. And the word Čelovek means human. But the actual definition of it, the pure definition, is that being who has this eye open, the third eye, the eye of consciousness open, that's a human. Otherwise, it's well considered not completely human. It's a very interesting idea. And so, in this vein, now that we've kind of set the stage, I want to discuss a question that was put to me by someone. Why do we need to actually have a God with form, a God with name? If God is limitless, nameless, formless, and all one and perfect, isn't it a limitation on our approach to God to say, this is God, this is a form, or Divine Mother, or Krishna, or Jesus, or even Buddha, or whatever we consider as a divine effigy? Why do we have to establish a contact with that? Because ultimately, to get to the highest, we need to transcend that. So, in answer to this, I would like to read something from one of the great, great saints of India. His name was Vinoba, and he was the main disciple of Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi is just not the liberator of India. He was considered a great saint. And his religious and spiritual wealth and greatness was far, far greater than any political accomplishment he made. And this Vinoba, he actually gave a series of talks on the Bhagavad Gita. And he gave it in prison. As you know, Mahatma Gandhi and his main followers, they were all imprisoned by the British from time to time. Mahatma Gandhi was in prison for years. Vinoba was too. But while he was there, he gave a series of talks to the actual inmates. And in one of his chapters about the Bhagavad Gita, he's talking about chapter 12, which is discussing this very nature of we're in a field of action as humans incarnated where we have karma to act. We have action we must engage in. And then there is the karma approach, the bhakti or the devotion to God, and the very highest jnana approach, seeing God as this unmanifested pure consciousness. Why do we engage in one to the next as we're taking steps to purify our action, to develop devotion to God, if ultimately we're going to arrive at that pure jnana approach or the yoga of knowledge? So I want to read, I actually took excerpts from that when I was putting together this book on Ramana Maharshi's teaching, which follows specifically. This is what we'll find in this book. Vinoba, a saintly devotee of Mahatma Gandhi, reveals in this book, Talks of the Gita, the most important point regarding the question that frequently arises during any spiritual pursuit of anyone, regardless of what approach they take. Because from east to west, what's important is not the type of lifestyle you assume in your spiritual life, but it's your angle of vision, your introspection, your intuitive understanding. Ultimately, it's not the religious practice, it's the effect of the practice. It's the effect that goodness has on our mind and heart, even outside of the realm of what we'd call spiritual endeavor. Just to be good, to be compassionate, to be loving, to be forgiving, and to be introspective and to root out those things which are the obstacles to goodness and love and compassion. You know, hate and greed and abusiveness of the mind, all these things are there. We need to diminish those and increase the virtues. So he says, bhakti will lead one, or devotion will lead one to the revelation of jnana, or knowledge. In the same breath, he says, the branch of jnana is nourished by the waters of bhakti. So he's talking about getting to that highest stage of perceiving God within us. But the way it's done is to perceive and to have devotion for that which is all around us, manifesting it as divinity. So, he says this. It's a path of difficulty and strife, as we all know. As with spiritual life, the same as with practical life, life and human life in the world can be fierce. We can have difficulty when we're trying to accomplish something. And it's the same in spiritual life. So you want to take the easy path, even though, as Bhagavad Gita explains, it's a war. Because there's dual nature in us. Even the Buddha talks about the suffering and the alleviation of suffering. In fact, if you look at the Dhammapada and all the sutras of this teaching of the Buddha, when he tells his stories and gives his analogies, he's couching them as the character is a warrior. in a battlefield. Even the Buddha, whose nonviolence is the actual hallmark of his approach, he's demonstrating the path of nonviolence as a soldier who is engaging in a battle but not reacting with fierceness, being subject to it. Ramana Maharshi speaks of the same thing when he says, to conquer and to achieve purity of mind, you don't attack the fort, in a sense, of the, you know, the inner nature which has been modified by karma. Literally, you just sit outside of it, and as these thoughts issue out into the mind, you just subdue them, annihilate them one by one. And so it's a self-transformation by just tolerance, compassion. So here we see, like for instance, the teaching of the Dalai Lama, compassion on ourselves first. And then we become this pure mind which is able to, you know, have compassion on others. So Vinoba says, apart from the point of easiness, he's talking about the efficaciousness of bhakti and devotion to an externalized manifest of God to arrive at that perception of formless, nameless, one pure consciousness. Apart from the point of easiness, there is one more point. Nirguna worship is fraught with some risk. He's talking about two Sanskrit words, nirguna and saguna. Saguna means an approach to God with form. You don't say he's outside, he's both outside and inside, but to increase devotion and increase God contact, you have an externalized manifestation of that which lies within. So you see, here's the dual nature. We don't say God is out there somewhere in heaven. He is within, and we are full of that nature. But in order to perceive that within, the steps that are taken by the great religions in Sanatana Dharma, the eternal religion, is first you see a manifestation outside, and God provided this as avatars. God came to earth, that divine pure consciousness came to earth in so many forms throughout the millennium of time. You know, the Buddha came, Jesus came. Buddha came in many different forms, Amitabha Buddha, Sakyamuni Buddha, Jesus and his saints came. Moses and the great prophets came. In India, the rishis came, and then 10 avatars of pure consciousness. Some Vishnu, some Shiva. All these things are just different manifestations of that one pure consciousness which lies in us. But the idea is God being actually the worker of our salvation, which is the real key to spiritual practice, because ultimately this is why devotion is necessary, because to get to this stage in this world, in this age, it's kind of, well, literally, the saints say virtually impossible without grace of God. So we need to have that grace. So we take up a name or a form of particular God or particular deity or particular aspect. If we say God is even, we take away the name and form, but God is love, God is compassion, God is mercy, God is forgiveness. Like Moses said, long suffering. And then we develop devotion to that. And that devotion then ultimately will be turned within, and we can have devotion to that formless which lies within us. So, nirguna is that higher state, in a sense, or that final state, where there is no name and form. It's without attributes. That's literally what nirguna means. As opposed to saguna, S-A-G-U-N-A. The word guna, we know from the Bhagavad Gita, is a modification of consciousness. Doesn't mean limitation, because Sri Krishna said even the gods, the devas, the angels, are subject to the gunas. This is what we are. We're a mixture of all these different things. So ultimately, that pure consciousness, which is without attributes, is that nirguna state. So he says, nirguna worship is fraught with some risk. Nirguna is full of knowledge and wisdom only. In saguna, or this form attributed God, there is love and tenderness and warmth of feeling. A devotee, or us, we're more secure in that, especially in a world which is fraught with, you know, strife. And as the Buddha said, there is suffering. And that's the first of the Four Noble Truths, the actual comprehension that we do suffer. And then we try to understand the suffering began, therefore it could end. And the fourth noble truth culminates with the Buddha saying, develop the path to the end of suffering. But the first realization we must make is the first noble truth, there is suffering. And even if we've gotten our life modified or put in a way where we're not actively suffering, still the Buddha and Jesus, even in the Vedas in India, they'll narrow it down to say hunger is a form of suffering. We must eat. We must feed. We must breathe. When air is taken away, we start to suffocate. It's a form of suffering. When we don't eat, we don't drink, we feel hunger and thirst. It's a form of suffering. Even if you wipe away all of the mental ramifications of suffering, the human is subject to these things. And the Buddha is saying that these basic modifications of suffering are identical to the mental ones. They can be eliminated the same way. So he goes on to say, self-reliance, inquiry, reflection, all these means taken together are of little avail when it comes to acquiring that pure contact with that pure love of God. In other words, really, all we can do in our life is only to become receptive to that grace. This is what he's saying. Of course, there are different approaches, but this is the pure Bhagavad Gita approach. Why? Because subtle impurities can be washed away only by the waters of devotion to God. Now, he's using the word subtle impurities. Things in the subconscious. He's talking about karma. We come into life with a lot of tendencies, a lot of karmas, a lot of predispositions to action. But there is a whole other realm in our subconscious we rarely contact. Those are subtle things. We can't work on them. It's hard to even acknowledge. We have in us some foible of distrust or fear or something that usually, even if it's a fear of death, we can feel that we don't have it. But then when aging, illness, and death approach, then it looms up. It lies underneath. It lies in the subconscious. But the idea is to contact it somehow or have it diminished somehow prior to the point where it becomes a massive, overwhelming fear of the mind. So he's saying these subtle impurities can be washed away by devotion to this externalized form of God, which ultimately will take within. So this bhakti, this devotion, washes away these impurities. Only bhakti, only devotion has the efficacy to do this. So yes, we can call it dependence if we like to be self-reliant and say, you know, I depend on nothing. I am that divine manifestation within. I don't need anything internal. He is saying that a devotee is more secure therein. Jnana does wash away gross impurities, but it is powerless to wash away the subtle ones. And some may say that we're giving a narrow meaning to the word knowledge, because if we have this knowledge, then nothing can affect us. But he says, to hold that knowledge cannot cleanse the mind completely because it undervalues this devotion which we're trying to develop. He says, my point is that it is hard to attain pure knowledge while living in a mortal body. Because we're just subject to too much suffering. Like I say, the Buddha explained this fully. We're just subject to too much of it. The knowledge that we can have while we're encased in this body is bound to be somewhat imperfect and incomplete. Here is the important word. Even if we do have knowledge of God, ultimately it is incomplete unless this devotion aspect is there as well. And we see throughout all religions, it's said God is the God of love. The Dalai Lama and all the great proponents of Buddhism say compassion. It's easy to get knowledge and understanding, but to have that knowledge and understanding coupled with devotion, that is the completeness we're after, and that is this pure consciousness, this dual aspect, this softness of heart, to be like, just the word in Sanskrit is madhura, just to be sweet, have a sweet nature in all circumstances. So, but then he'll conclude to say, this saguna aspect, this devotion to God, needs help from the nirguna. So they're both acting simultaneously. One must eventually learn to free oneself from attachment to and preoccupation from individuals and outer forms. So here now he's speaking of the highest attainment. Ultimately, we must free ourselves from this seeming dependence on an external form of God, which really the spiritual great masters and saints are saying, it's a stage we need to employ and ultimately we'll transcend it. Many say it's a stage which also brings development, but it also conveys this sweetness because you have contact with God. You have contact with that inner, like, you feel loved. You feel the embrace of superhuman consciousness. And it's so sweet, then you're able to employ tapas and these different austerities, or to live a simple life and to simplify the acquisition of wealth and things that give, yes, some alleviation to suffering, but this sweetness you get from God contact, this comes mainly from that devotion. Knowledge will not give that. So here's the key. So besides the fact it's an eventual stage that must be transcended, while we're in that stage, it's so sweet because God is that pure sweetness, and that comes to us and we feel it. And we're then truly able to love and exercise compassion on the manifestation of God. So he ends by saying, this devotion to God is indeed the source of inspiration, but the ultimate culmination must be in this formless nirguna approach to God. In commitment to principles, self-knowledge must ultimately emerge from the womb of devotion. So here it's beautiful, and this is the way they do it in the East. It's just like a little child from birth. The womb of devotion, from that you come out and you grow and you mature into this. And it's a stage. And so, like all things in life, but as we remember even our childhood days, we can remember usually sweeter times than an adulthood, because we were free, we had, you know, of course we had trouble because it was school and parents and all the things that were seemingly oppressed because they're trying to mold us. But that kind of feeling of independence that comes with this devotion. So he says, the plant of bhakti must blossom into the flower of self-knowledge. And so there we are. And that's the key, that we realize, just like everything in nature, when you're a plant, and so Sri Ramakrishna speaks about this so beautifully, you need to hedge it around a little. And so in other words, as you're maturing in spiritual life, you're in a sense hedging around this devotion to God. And so the cows, the cattle, all the things that in the world that can gnaw at you, they won't get at you and eat you alive until you grow and become strong. And at that point, you don't need the hedge, ultimately. But then what many people find, they never want to abandon it because of this sweetness that contact of God does.